Hey folks, Jared Sylvester here. Thank you so much for checking out this podcast from Repurposed.
People want to hear the story. They want to know what to do to help prepare themselves for the next crisis. So my mission, I can't make them do it, but I can tell them the impact of what we did well and what we didn't do well on 9/11, and hopefully that will resonate with them to take the necessary steps.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Repurposed, a show dedicated to inspire you to live a life of purpose, of meaning, of intentionality, and of impact. I'm your host, Jared Sylvester of Taegis Financial Group, a retirement planning firm based in West Central Minnesota, where we teach and inspire true wealth. If you want more information on Taegis Financial Group, just go to our website, taegisfinancial.com. Well, on this week's episode of Repurposed, I'm bringing you an interview with retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert J. Darling. Lieutenant Colonel Darling was working for the White House Military Office during the events of 9/11. And after that first plane hit the North Tower in New York City on 9/11, he then spent the next 24 hours in the president's bunker beneath the White House, rubbing shoulders with President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld. In this podcast, Lieutenant Colonel Darling recalls personal stories from that infamous day, and he also sheds light on his own purpose and how we can all have more impact in our lives. Here's my chat with Robert J. Darling. I got a chance to hear you speak a while back. You have such an incredible story. You were actually in the bunkers with President Bush during 9/11. That not many people can say that, can they?
No, that's for sure. I was working for the White House Military Office. I was a Marine. I'm a Marine aviator, a helicopter pilot, and I flew President Clinton around with Marine Helicopter Squadron 1, and then I was part of the White House Military Office. And it just so happened to be on 9/11, I was working there adjacent to the White House in the Eisenhower building when the attack on America began. They ultimately evacuated the White House, and I responded to that bunker complex that you referred to, known as the President's Emergency Operations Center.
How long did your military background go back before 9/11?
That was my 14th year in the Marine Corps. Wow. And I was doing, like I said, airlift operations. And what we do in support of the president in airlift operations is we move all those limousines, helicopters, Secret Service, snipers, doctors, phone lines, everything in advance of the president's visit anywhere in the world.
How did you get into military? You were raised in New York, an East Coast guy. How did your life transition into a life of military?
You know, it's interesting. I grew up in a family of four boys. You know, my dad served in the Navy for 2 years. I had no real military aspirations my whole life. I initially wanted to be a stockbroker. I wanted to live in East Hampton and have a mansion on a hill. And it wasn't until my freshman year at Iona College that we had the 1983 Beirut bombing in Lebanon. And some of the juniors and seniors at the time at Iona were met all of a sudden joining the Marine Corps, getting involved in geopolitics around the world. I didn't even know where Beirut was. I didn't have an interest in that. And then when I saw how the campus was reacting to this terrorist attack by this Islamic jihadist group halfway around the world, I became more aware of the Marine Corps and what they had to offer. And then I myself ultimately joined the Marine Corps right there out of college.
Before we get into 9/11, I want you to share some of the stories that I've heard you share with 9/11, because it literally brought me chills, you know, you telling some of these stories. Talk a little bit about what you do now, kind of fast forward to the other side of your career. What do you do now? Talk about your book.
So I retired out of the Marine Corps in 2007. And then I dabbled in corporate America. I went to work for a big company, then a small company. And ultimately, in 2011, I formed my own company called Quantitative Analytics. And our primary purpose is to support the Navy right here at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. with financial analytics, cost management. And that's what I've been doing ever since. But in the meantime, I wrote the book of my experience, what happened on 9/11. And the book was called 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker. In 2010, the National Security Council of the White House approved the publication of my book and approved me going around the country telling this story of the events of 9/11 from underground, at the White House campus, standing shoulder to shoulder with our nation's leaders. And that's sort of what I do now. I have quantitative analytics, and I get to go tell my story from 9/11 to anybody who will listen.
I think that's interesting that you had to get clearance. In fact, I remember thinking that when I was hearing you speak, I'm like, how is he able to share all this? Because this seems like pretty sensitive information.
Well, I followed the rules straight up. I went to go see them first. I told them I had this story. They listened to the story, but it was interesting. They came back and said, listen, PowerPoint slides really don't do it for us, because whenever you put a bullet on a PowerPoint, who knows what you're going to say about that next time. So they really wanted to see a manuscript. So I followed the rules, and I remember what they really laid it out very clear for me. They said, listen, don't talk about covert people or classified programs or undisclosed places. The White House presidential bunker, I can't give any details out about it, but it's public knowledge that it exists. So I followed the rules. I got permission, and I'm pretty careful about staying within those rules everywhere I go.
Wow. Well, let's get into 9/11. I mean, an event that we all can remember. I mean, I was actually in college at the time. I remember turning on the television in the morning, getting ready for class, and just, you know, everybody walking around in a fog, you know, throughout that day. You were right in the midst of it, in Washington, D.C. Can you just kind of share some of those stories from the book and from your presentation?
Sure. Like I said initially, I was working in the White House Airlift Operations Office, and that's in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, just adjacent to the West Wing of the White House. My primary job was to track President Bush's whereabouts down in Sarasota, Florida, and my mission was logistics. We had asked the Air Force to move all the limousines, the helicopters, the Secret Service, the snipers, the doctors, everywhere he goes. So the minute he's wheels up out of Sarasota, coming back to Washington, D.C., our job then in airlift operations is to clean up all those assets and move them to a new location. Well, and that was what we were doing that day. And then all of a sudden, somebody came running in to tell us to turn on the TV that apparently a small airplane struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center complex.
That's right. And President Bush was he was in Florida at the time, right, at a school.
He was doing an education swing, if you will. He's in Sarasota, Florida, and we were tracking his movements. We expected him to be wheels up that day about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, when all of a sudden at 8:46 and then at 9:03, while the world watched to include us in the Eisenhower building, we saw United Airlines Flight 175 flee into the South Tower at obviously what looked like full power to us.
What's going through your mind at that point? I mean, does your military train just kind of kick in? Are you just kind of in awe, like the rest of the world watching? What's your mindset at that point?
You know, when the first tower was hit at 8:46, we were in awe like everybody else. We just thought initial reports were a small Cessna. Maybe the pilot had some type of emergency or a heart attack or something and hit that building. But then we started seeing the pictures initially. That's a pretty big hole in a very big building. There must be much more going on. But when United 175 hit the South Tower, we immediately became involved. It was my boss, who was a Fulbert colonel. He said, everybody stop what you're doing. We have a full-blown terrorist event unfolding right before our eyes in the city of New York. At that point, it became a national mission, and we were part of that national mission.
And then you were kind of a part of trying to get him in the air, because you mentioned in your presentation the safest place for a president during an attack is actually in the air. Talk about the logistics and the plan to try to get the president up in the air as fast as he can and basically run the country from an airplane.
Sure. You know, we outfitted, he's got some great assets and tools available to him. You know, Air Force One is a very modern, fast, big airplane. The president can talk to any world leader, execute any military operational plan, and it is a flying White House, if you will. So they always want to get the president airborne, where he has all the access to all the technology and resources to the people that he needs to reach out and talk to on any given national tragedy or any given day. Yeah. And that's what we're trying to do that day. So our mission was to support that effort. If the president got airborne and needed to go somewhere, we needed to get extra helicopters, limousines, Secret Service, doctors, everything he would need to be wherever he decided to go that day. And that became our primary focus.
You said that they'll fly at, like you said, some insane height at some insane speed, just to keep him moving, so to speak, right?
They can go way above airliner traffic, and they put him up there. They can put fighter aircraft around him. He can talk to any world leader. He can execute any military plan. He's obviously in touch with his national command authority, being the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon. And together they can run the nation and respond to any threat against our nation right there from Air Force.
You're alongside Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. You're rubbing shoulders with these folks down in the bunker while this is all happening. I mean, just walk us through that day. At some point, you got President Bush back to the White House later that night. Was that correct?
That is absolutely correct. You know, Jared, when we got down, after the second tower was hit at 9:03, eventually we were overflown. The White House was violated, had an aircraft over top of it that violated that prohibited airspace. And then within moments, we had breaking news. We have a fire and explosion over the Pentagon right across the Potomac River. So now we have a multi-city air attack in America unfolding. And they evacuated the White House at 9:45. That's like that. Last time that was evacuated was when Dolly Madison was literally running out the back door in 1814 with a print of George Washington when the British were burning down Washington, D.C. But here we are evacuating the White House again. During that time, I went underground to do logistics in support of the president that I just described to you. And when I got down there, I found the vice president's military aide, another military officer, asked me for help answering the phones. I found an empty cubicle. The phone was ringing, and it changed my day in its entirety right from that moment forward.
You mentioned that you talked about the fog of war. Explain to folks what that means.
You know, the fog of war is when you don't have the total picture of information. Your situational awareness is degraded in some way, shape, or form, but yet a response needs to be taken. And sometimes in fog of war, it's you can easily make a mistake. In this case, on 9/11, we had an aircraft that violated Washington, D.C. airspace right around 10:12 that day and appeared to be coming towards the White House. So now we had fighter aircraft. We're trying to get the Pentagon to tell us what fires in the area to engage this unidentified aircraft, which we call a bogey. If we identify him as hostile, we'll call it a bandit. But we didn't know what it was. But it was way too close to the White House coming towards us. And we were looking for a fighter to actually shoot this aircraft down. And it turned out to be, A, we didn't have a fighter jet available. And B, that was a medevac helicopter heading for the Pentagon to go save lives, to help out with the burn victims from the impact of Flight 77 that day. In this case, if we had a fighter, we would have shot down a military medevac or medical helicopter doing its mission to go save lives. It just worked out for us that, in fact, have that tragedy.
And there was another scenario, too, of a small plane that was unidentified. It wasn't in Washington, D.C., right? I want to say it was further south. Can you tell that story where you actually sent fighter jets to go knock down this plane? Because at this point, air travel is completely shut down across the country. There should be no planes, right, in the sky except for military planes. And there was another one down south that you sent two fighter jets on, right?
That's right. And this aircraft, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we had an unidentified aircraft that was flying towards the president's ranch in Crawford, Texas. President Bush's, home down there in Crawford is a ranch.
Right.
And this aircraft was pointing and flying towards the president's ranch. So we immediately assumed it was a bad guy trying to attack the president's home. So we ended up calling the Pentagon. They scrambled two F-16s out of San Antonio, Kelly Air Force Base. They were supersonic with orders to shoot this aircraft down before it got to the president's ranch. And as they got close enough to it, the F-16s could tell that this was a slow-moving, non-hostile threat, but ended up going by a crop duster at supersonic speeds. And crop dusters don't have radio. So this poor guy didn't know what was going on in the world when two fighter jets were closing in on him at supersonic speeds to intercept him before he got to the president's property. He's lucky the aircraft didn't come apart in flight as they overflew.
I was going to say, a crop duster would almost disintegrate due to the sonic boom. What did that guy experience with your training? What did he experience when those two jets flew by him?
He was pretty uncomfortable, I can tell you that, because just the sound of those aircraft coming by you, it must be like a tornado with the windows open. And then when they went vertical on that, we actually made light of it down the bunker complex, saying that guy, when he sobered up, he went to go see the sheriff and said he just saw two UFOs, because it must have been a pretty horrific event for him as they went by him.
Yeah, I mean, these are lighthearted stories coming out of one of the most tragic days in U.S. history, but it's different to reflect on now. But what an experience for you. You talk about leadership and then tying a lot of your experience with that day and your military training to leadership and business nowadays. How do you make that connection?
Well, I tell you, I give the Marine Corps so much credit for my ability to run either this small company or consult on crisis leadership and decision making. All those lessons, and I refer back to my 21 years in the Marine Corps, I never forgot what we learned early on. And pretty much from our drill instructors getting in our face and yelling in our ears, they were telling us from day one to get it done, to stop the whining. Just get up, move forward, accomplish the mission, and then once you get there, you reevaluate what went well, what didn't go well, make a new plan, and you do it again. But they totally were trying to get everyone just to stop thinking about themselves, the I and the me, and think about the team and how important it is to move forward and get things done. So, and that's how I've been living my life ever since. I really give credit to those drill instructors and those fellow Marines that I got to meet along my journey, who are so accomplished and just incredible leaders that get things done.
Yeah, you're the father of two boys in their 20s. How have these experiences and this training translated to you into being a father and passing it on to your kids?
Well, you know, I'm certainly not the great Santini, that's for sure. You know, a much kindler, gentler father, but I have two incredible kids, and they're their own people for sure. My oldest son Michael is very analytical. He's very well read. He went to George Washington University. He wants to someday get involved in some type of geopolitical career, whether he's writing white papers for the State Department or doing things for intel agencies. But he's very driven that way to contribute to America. My youngest son, Matthew, who's now 21, is very athletic. He's a tennis instructor. He's constantly mentoring and training others to play tennis to higher level of, you know, college level type athleticism. And he's just a great natural leader. But neither one of them had aspirations for the military service. They're going to serve this country in some way, shape, or form, but they're going to find their own way to do it.
Interesting. Interesting. Talk about purpose. You know, you've had such incredible roles in the military and such an integral part of even of 9/11. And now you're doing consulting, got your own business, going out and speaking. You're now an author. If I were to say, what is your purpose, what would you say?
You know, when I look back, what's my reason for doing what I do on any single day? What's my purpose, right? Well, let's just talk about 9/11. You know, one of the things I witnessed as I stood shoulder to shoulder with Cheney and Dr. Rice and eventually President Bush was really two things. Standing in that bunker complex where the attack on America was happening, I learned that really the strength and resiliency of ordinary Americans in this country is unmatched anywhere in the world. The folks in New York and the people on Flight 93 and those over at the Pentagon who went right back into the fire, stormed the cockpit, were the last ones out of those towers to save the lives of other ordinary Americans really moved me. I also learned that our military, though being the most powerful military force in the world, is slow to respond. We're big. We just can't get anywhere quickly necessarily when we're under attack. And so now I'm on a mission, and I realize my mission may not be to prevent another 9/11, though I would love to see that happen. But I do want to make sure I tell everybody what happened at the highest levels of our government so they don't forget, so they take the necessary steps to strengthen their companies and their organizations and even their families. So the next time we have a national tragedy, we're not just relying on resilience, but instead we have a plan. We have awareness, we practice communications, we know where we're going to go to if our home is untenable or our businesses are shut down, that we have some, we're not just wandering like sheep around our streets and in our states, that we actually have a plan to go and better respond to any type of either a terrorist attack or natural man-made disaster in America.
Yeah, you mentioned the word mission, which I thought was really interesting. It seems like purpose and mission kind of tend to go hand in hand. You know, as you've gotten older, you've had these huge seasons of your life. Do you feel more mission focused even now, you know, years after being out of the military than you did now? Or how would you articulate that?
Well, the mission focus that you're referring to couldn't be clearer with me. Even as I travel around and I either talk to banking associations or electrical distributors or any type of organizations, people want to hear the story. They want to know what to do to help prepare themselves for the next crisis. So my mission is, I can't make them do it, but I can tell them the impact of what we did well and what we didn't do well on 9/11. And hopefully that will resonate with them to take the necessary steps to save their people, either those that work for them, those they know, those who live in their communities, to work closer with your first responders, to show a little respect to what they do for us on any given day. Because in the end, we're going to need each and every one of us. We're going to need each other to overcome the next serious event in our country. It's going to come down to people helping people. So my mission and my purpose is to continue to tell the story and hopefully inspire folks to get out there and take the next step to get involved, to have a plan and to be just as resilient, but a lot more prepared.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Last question I'll ask you and I ask all of my interviewees. It's one of my favorite questions to ask people. I'd love to hear your perspective on this. How can we, and even myself, impact people more? How can we be people of greater impact? Something simple we could even start doing today.
Well, I gotta tell you, Jared, I found that even, you know, I'm standing there in uniform, 21 years in the Marine Corps, the whole thing, that people are more inspired by what you do, not necessarily what you say. There is no speech out there that you're gonna give somebody to get them moving or off the couch or to join the military or some type of public service to get involved in their communities. They're gonna need to see what you have accomplished in your life and then wanna imitate that or emulate what you have accomplished. So it's more about what you do and what you get done than what you could ever say to anybody to inspire them. So keep moving forward, get those books written, give those speeches, keep doing what you're doing in public service and everything that I saw that you did in Minnesota. You're a natural leader, and that's what people will latch onto and remember you for. They want to see action, not words.
I like that. I appreciate that. It reminds me, somebody else said passion recently on a podcast. If you want to have impact, have passion, and I can sense that coming out of you, and I would connect with that. I think we're called to be passionate about something, and that seems like whether you're in sales or whatever, passion is the thing. It's like that secret sauce that gets people on board and inspires people, just like you're talking about. And you got that passion too, and I could sense that too when I heard you speak. So keep on doing what you're doing as well.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Tell people where they can find more about you, more about the book.
I'll have my website. It's Robert, the letter J, Joseph, robertjdarling.com. And you can learn more about my public speaking and where I've been and my message to all. And please find the book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01, The White House.
Yeah, and if the book has anything to do with your presentation and the stories that come out of there, like I said, it was fascinating, fascinating stories. You got to check it out.
Well, thanks. Great being with you today.
All right, thanks so much. I sure hope you enjoyed this chat with Lieutenant Colonel Robert J. Darling. To find out more information on him or his book called 24 Hours in the President's Bunker, go to his website, robertjdarling.com. And just on a personal note, if you ever have the chance to hear him speak and give his presentation, I would highly recommend it. Like I said at the end of our interview, I've heard it, and some of the stories he had were just absolutely incredible. So let's do a little recap. When it comes to purpose, he said that he wanted to use his story and tell his story to help people, families, and businesses prepare and build plans in case a crisis strikes. But one thing that he said that I thought was significant, he said that people want to hear the story. And I think that goes for everybody listening here today. You all have a story to tell, especially when it comes to your faith. And I know sharing our faith is tough. I fall into that boat as well. We don't want to get into debates or arguments with people about Jesus. We don't want to offend anybody nowadays. But how in the world could anyone argue or be offended with your story, right? So share your story. Share your faith. People want to hear it, and more so, they need to hear it. And when it comes to having impact, he said that people are way more inspired by what you do rather than what you say. They want to see what you've accomplished. And isn't that true? Talk is so cheap. If you want to impact others, live out your faith, live out your values, live out those characteristics that you want to see lived out in others. That'll do it for this week's episode of Repurpose. Just a reminder, this show is based on a book by Ben Tages called Repurpose, The Untold Story of Retirement in America. If you want the first two chapters of that book totally free, just go to our website, tagesfinancial.com, and click on Heard Us on the Radio. It's a little button in the upper right-hand corner for your free gift just for listening here today. Also, a big thanks to Faith Radio for helping us sponsor this program. If you missed any or all of this episode, visit myfaithradio.com to hear or download the podcast there. I'm Jared Sebastian, your host. We'll see you next time on Repurposed. Thanks so much for checking out this episode of Repurposed. Just a reminder, these podcasts are only available because of generous support of people just like you. If you'd like to make a gift and support Faith Radio, go to the website, myfaithradio.com. Also, another way you can help is by sharing these podcasts on social media and subscribing. Just click subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast player, and you'll be sure to never miss a show.